I've been spending so much time talking about craft distillers that I think it's time I put my money where my mouth is and we talk about some craft distillers. Now, the guests that I have on here today are going to help us do exactly that. What's up, guys? My name is Chris, and you are listening to the Whiskey Noobs Podcast. And today on Whiskey Noobs, we have Devin and Chase from American Mash and Grain. And if you don't know what American Mash and Grain is, you're about to find out. But they spotlight craft distillers. They talk about craft distillers, and they work with them to make their blended whiskey release Borrowed Page, which I'm going to try to put in front of the camera for those who are watching a video. Borrowed Page is a blend of these different craft distillers whiskeys that they combine, and there's a volume one and a volume two, and we're going to do reviews of both of them. We're going to talk about volume one, talk about the flavors that went into it, and then I'm going to talk about volume two and the flavors that I get from it, what it tastes like and why I think it's different. And we're going to talk about American Mash and Grain craft distillers, why it's so important to talk about them and their story. And of course, talk about the awesome whiskeys that they have tasted that they blended together to make these Borrowed Page releases. Before I cut to that interview, it's worth mentioning, if you listen to this episode and you like the sound of either of these releases, Borrowed Page Volume 1 or 2, as of the recording of this episode, they are both available on my bottle shop. So if you've been to my bottle shop, it's at the link in my bio on both Instagram and TikTok. You can go to my bottle shop. Bottles that I like are on there, and if you buy them through there, I will make a small commission, so it's very much appreciated. And also, bottles that are hard to get your hands on are on there, like these Borrowed Pages. These are limited releases. As we talk about in this episode, once it's gone forever. So if you're interested in trying either of these, I personally would recommend them. I like them. Volume 2 is what I drank tonight during this podcast, and it's so different. I enjoy it all. I'm gushing. I'm going to stop right now. But if you want to try them both, they are available at my bottle shop. Go to the link in my bio on Instagram at @whiskey_noobs, on TikTok at @whiskeynoobspodcast. Go to the link in my bio, check it out. But without further ado, I will cut to my conversation with Chase and Devin from American Mash and Grain. First of all, before we get started, anytime I have more than just me, I like to have everybody say their name so that people can put a name to the voice and they know who's talking. So if you guys could just go ahead and say your name, and then we'll get into American Mash and Grain as well.
Cool. My name is Devin Urshow.
Chase Langdon.
All We're right.
American Mash and Grain.
No, that's perfect. Yeah. American Mash and Grain, which we're going to get into what American Mash and Grain is, what Borrowed Page is, which is what I'm currently pouring up right here. Those of you watching the video version of this can see that. But before we get into that, I have to start. I start everybody off with the same question. Should be an easy question. If it's not an easy question, I think you're on the wrong podcast. Where did your love of whiskey begin?
I'll let Devin go first because my story is like far less interesting, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel like my, you know, I have an answer to that question, and then Chase's answer is me.
Yeah, more or less.
Okay. I have that a lot when I have groups on, so.
So I'm also going to pour us a little bit of Borrowed Page Volume 1, so we're all enjoying some Borrowed Page while we're talking. But I've always enjoyed whiskey, even when we were, you know, in high school, a little taboo, I guess. Newsflash, people drink alcohol in high school sometimes.
What? Not me, no.
But even when we were in high school, a lot of our friends would drink beer when we would hang out. I preferred whiskey back then. But it was really just that I liked the taste of it more than watered-down beer that you get when you're young and don't have a lot of money and just kind of want to play beer pong. And that's the...
And we're not knocking that for all you 20-year-olds out there, 18-year-olds. I'm fully in that mold. It's fantastic.
Well, and I certainly don't recommend playing beer pong with whiskey.
No, don't do that.
Yeah.
We've had those situations as well. They have not gone well. So I always had an appreciation for it, but where it really began, in 2017, my wife and I went on a trip to Ireland, vacation, the two of us, and we accidentally found ourselves in the Irish Whiskey Museum in Dublin. Because we had a tour of Trinity College, but we got there a little bit early. There was a tour that was just about to start at the Irish Whiskey Museum, which is just across the street. So we jumped on that tour, and I just fell in love with Irish whiskey. I fell in love with history of whiskey, the process of whiskey. I had no idea how it was made up until that point. So I spent the rest of that vacation learning everything I could about Irish whiskey and drinking as much Irish whiskey as I could. And then when I came back to America, I just wanted to know about all different kinds of whiskey. I wanted to know about bourbon and rye, and, you know, American single malt was really starting to take off at that point with producers like Westland and Virginia Distillery Company and all those people coming out with really cool stuff. So, you know, I really dove deep into it. I have a few certifications under my belt, executive bourbon steward through the Stave and Thief Society out of Moonshine University, level 2 award recipient with distinction from the WSET, the Wine and Spirits Education Trust out in the UK. And then I started picking up some kind of side gigs because I was working in film and television in New York, and picking up some side gigs. I got a brand ambassador job working for Wiggle Whiskey in Pittsburgh. So I would show up and sort of be the face to their accounts in New York City. So I'd go to bars and liquor stores and host events and do tastings. And then I became a tour guide at Kings County Distillery in Brooklyn, which really became like a second home for me. And then eventually took over as the tour and events manager for a brief period of time at Kings County Distillery during the pandemic, helping them sort of bring back in-person events and experiences and building out their virtual tasting program. But when the pandemic initially hit, I felt like I was sort of building up all this good momentum with whiskey, and I could really see it as a new career for me. I really hated working in film and television and wanted to get out so badly. And then the pandemic hit, and I was feeling really distraught. I feel like that's a good introduction for you.
Yeah, so this is where I kind of enter. Like, I always liked whiskey, but I was always kind of a I'll drink anything kind of person. And, you know, if I'm being honest, I still kind of am. Yeah. Although I fully bought it. I don't do vodka. We've sworn that off. We're on that bandwagon. But, like, beer, wine, sake, big into all that. But COVID happened. Mm-hmm. I was living in New Orleans at the time. And, you know, we couldn't go out and we were working remotely. I really just got a bit stir crazy. And so kind of this idea came about where Devin was going deep this down this path of whiskey and kind of learning as much as he possibly could about it. I really just wanted an excuse to get on some Zoom calls and drink whiskey with my friends. So I concocted this idea. I was like, oh, like, we'll start a blog website. We'll talk to craft whiskey producers. Maybe they'll send us some free samples. And then really the more I've learned and really tumbled down this rabbit hole, I've really come to appreciate it in a much deeper level over the last, I mean, sneaking up on 3 years.
Plus 3 years now.
Yeah, 3+ years.
It's our third year anniversary that the website launched last month or this month. This month.
Yeah, it's just been an incredible journey. And now I do thoroughly appreciate it on a deep and meaningful level. That's not just, oh, I have whiskey instead of Natty Light. I'll drink whiskey, I suppose. Yeah.
The pace at which he drinks it might, you know, belie that statement, but.
Okay.
You don't even go down that.
So then you guys knew each other prior to all this, even though you were far apart geographically.
Yeah, we met on the second day of kindergarten.
Awesome.
That's when we became best friends. We actually, the story is that we are friends because we got in trouble at school. So I came to this new school in kindergarten. Chase had been there for a whole half year before me. He arrived halfway through pre-kindergarten. So I guess he thought he, you know, ran the place or something. we don't remember what it is we got in trouble about.
I'm confident it was your fault, but yeah. The details are a bit hazy. Yeah.
Well, it's probably a little bit like, I imagine it had something to do with getting in line and some pushing and shoving and stuff. But, you know, I was trying to stand up for myself as the new kid and, you know.
Yeah. Kindergarten in prison, right? You know, the first thing you got to do is go find the toughest guy in the playground.
Biggest, toughest kid. Yeah,
exactly. Establish dominance.
That's
yes.
What my mom taught me, you know. At our school, when you got in trouble, the punishment was called getting benched, which meant that you had to sit on a bench, which was next to the bench the teachers sat at. And the bench faced the entire playground. So you got to watch all the other kids have recess and play while you sat on a bench next to the teachers. But we really bonded on that bench.
Yeah. We did. Yeah. We had a lot in common as kindergartners. Power Rangers was a common interest, so we really leaned on that one.
Apple juice.
No. Big juice consumers. So, you know, it was a friendship destined to be, I suppose.
Yeah.
Wow, yeah. Yeah, that sounds fantastic. So that's good to hear. So So basically, yeah. So you got into this, into the whiskey, and you guys decided during the pandemic you're going to come out with this blog. And that actually answers one of the questions I wanted to ask, which is where did American Mash and Grain come from? So that's what got you started. And that's one of the things I want to get at is how we got to Borrowed Page from it being like a blog idea, basically. So originally, when you guys decided you want to come out with this blog, what was like the primary goal of this, the media side of American Mash and Grain? You know, could have been you could have gone with any type of blog. What was your specific niche you guys were aiming at with that?
Yeah, so to give a little bit more context, so Devin has all kind of the whiskey credentials. I do come from more of a brand marketing and storytelling background. Okay. So the original concept was, can we take his kind of product expertise and my sort of brand expertise or background and married it together to create holistic stories about these people doing amazing things? We looked at all the common trends of what media is doing these days, getting shorter, more video oriented, all about the flashy thumbnails and the catchy headlines. We said, you know what? Common sense. We're not going to do any of those things.
Yeah.
And instead, we're going to interview these people and write extremely long and detailed stories. And I don't know if that was the right choice or the wrong choice, but I definitely think it was kind of the approach that was most fitting of the endeavor that these independent craft producers are taking on. We kind of looked at the landscape of craft or whiskey, the media that was coming out, and it really was very tasting notes oriented. And if you're one of the big producers and everyone kind of knows your brand story, that's all fine and good. The individual products can kind of be what's maybe most important to the consumer. But when you're a new independent craft producer and you're trying to get your name out there and you're trying to get people to understand something about you so they can appreciate something about the product, you really don't want to divorce the story from the product. And so that's why it became such a big kind of focal point of American Mash and Grain to really try and tell complete stories about the people, the place, the process, the philosophies behind these amazing whiskeys.
Yeah, and I think we knew that craft was where we wanted to focus our energy on because we felt like the story of Kentucky bourbon had been told, was being told, and millions of dollars were being poured into telling that story. And as somebody who had worked for two craft distilleries at that time and saw, you know, the kind of unique profiles and unique methods and ties into history and everything that was going on in, with these smaller producers, I think that we knew that craft was where we wanted to focus our attention and tell those stories.
Okay. Yeah. And I feel like that's really appreciated too. So this isn't something I even planned to talk about, but I think it's important to mention because I think we see brands going towards what you had originally said. And that is, let's talk about our tasting notes. Let's talk about the mash bill. Let's just talk about what it's going to taste like when they buy it. And that's great. I love as much detail as I can get about a whiskey, but then you do lose something there because I find myself, especially a lot of times with these craft distillers, they don't have the huge flashy website that they've been developing for a dozen years now. And you can log in and you can find their whiskey and you can find what it tastes like, but you can't find out much about the distillery. Like, you can't find out what's going to happen if you go visit. You can't find out where they came from, what their goals are, what they're doing. So I think that's appreciated to not lose that story aspect. And I think in this, not to get too philosophical here, but in this TikTok 20 seconds and swipe culture where we don't have our attention on anything too long, it becomes lost the importance of having that background and understanding what it is that you're drinking, where it came from, those sorts of things. So,
yeah, honestly, I don't mean to cut you off. Like, you know, I don't think anyone can call themselves a true appreciator of whiskey if they don't also appreciate patience and time and investment of energy, right? Like, so many qualities about whiskey that make it great and romantic in many ways really are counter to this short attention span, flashy, you know, kind of impulsivity of the current media landscape. And, you know, while it wasn't necessarily a conscious choice to try and marry our storytelling approach to that philosophy, I think going that route of more complete, more intentional, more methodical, it has really been a benefit for us trying to tell the quality stories we want to tell about these craft producers.
Yeah, and I think sort of a lofty hope, and I think that we're starting to get there, is that we wanted, you know, to become a resource for people that really wanted to find out information about these people, to sort of Chase's point about, like, you know, real whiskey enthusiast nerds, like, wanting to know everything, like, wanting to know the details. We wanted to, you know, aside from maybe their own personal website or their own personal brand ambassadors or whatever, I think we wanted to kind of become known as a place where it's like, oh, do you want to know pretty much everything there is to know about this distillery? Go to American Mash and Grain and read their profile of them. And that's kind of the approach that we have when we write these features. And they've become a little bit less, like, you know,
robotic
ever since I stopped writing them. you know, we hired a head writer named Megan Swanson, who's an incredible writer and storyteller. And she has really helped to shape the voice of those features. And I think now they strike a really nice balance between very informative, like, you're still going to find out, you know, how they came to be, you know, the sacrifices they've made, and your real nerdy stuff, like, where does their still come from? How big is it? You know, what kind of varietal of grain do they use? What barrels? How do they age? You're going to find all that stuff, but you're also going to be really moved by the storytelling. And a lot of that has been Megan's influence since we brought her on the team.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I know you mentioned in the beginning you didn't know if it was the right or the wrong decision to go that route, but I do think that it came at a time that it's necessary. And I don't just say that because, obviously, like, at a time where we're swiping every 15 seconds, I'm making a podcast that lasts 30 minutes to an hour. So you need to focus in. I totally agree. And that's kind of one of the things I try to accomplish when I have distillers on. A lot of the times the questions I'm asking them are genuine questions that I have that I think people out there are wanting to know. And so I think that's very important to capture that, because it goes hand in hand with, I think you mentioned this, Chase, it goes hand in hand. You know, when you're having a glass of whiskey, you're kind of pausing and focusing in on something and enjoying it for what it is. And it goes hand in hand to think you'd want to do that same thing when you're learning about the background of a whiskey brand and actually want to get the full story. And I know a lot of my following wants that full story. And so that's one of the things I really appreciate about it.
Yeah. And listen, I'm coming from the marketing storytelling side of things. I actually fundamentally believe that the story should influence the enjoyment and the appreciation of the whiskey. Like, I know a lot of people do the blind tasting. I see the value of it. I know you do it. Like, when you're really trying to you know, focus in on just the product, it's an absolute necessity. But, you know, if we're being honest, like, if we're drinking whiskey, if I drink some whiskey after eating tacos versus a salad, it's going to taste different. Like, the tasting experience is going to be variable, but, like, the enjoyment, right? If I share a special whiskey on my wedding day, for example, like, every time I go back to the whiskey, it is, like, more enjoyable and more special because of that. And I think the true stories, not these kind of manufactured marketing stories, but the true stories of these craft producers who are sacrificing so much, like, the value of that actually should be appreciated and felt in, when you're consuming the spirit itself, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you guys are essentially working now. So, and I want to know if this was the plan from the beginning or not, but you're working to not only have the story half of it, but you're working with these distillers and you are coming out with Borrowed Page, which we are going to talk about. But was that originally the intent, or is this something that kind of came along as the snowball got rolling?
Both.
Yeah.
I would say, okay, the idea of putting out a blended product and working with distillers that we had featured on the website was something that Chase and I talked about at the very beginning in terms of, you know, where this could grow to. We really had no idea what this was going to be when we started it. I think, kind of like Chase said, worst case scenario, we hop on a few Zoom calls and talk to some interesting people and drink some free whiskey. Best case scenario, we had all these lofty hopes for it. One of those hopes was definitely to put something out that was blended. But outside of that very simple idea, that's kind of where it lived for a couple, almost 2 years.
And honestly, like, I mean, how many of us over the course of our life would be like, you know, it'd be awesome if we started a bar, or we opened a bar, or we opened a brewery, right? Like, there is this kind of like, just through the natural course, like, oh, the thought is going to cross your mind. And I think that's kind of where we were. But having spent a few years talking to these people who are taking out second mortgages, who are leaving well, you know, secure, well-paying jobs, who are
emptying their 401k.
Yeah, like, yeah, really sacrificed. Like, it's hard not to be inspired by that.
Yeah.
And if anything, I think while the idea may have pre-existed to some degree and not fully formed, the motivation to actually follow through and doing it is very much inspired and born out of the kind of the relationships we've built through the course of the website.
Yeah. Well, and what Borrowed Page has become really was not there at the beginning.
No.
Okay. So yeah, let's get into that. What Borrowed Page is. For those listening, let's say they've never even heard of it. They don't know what's going on. I think you guys are onto something, and I hadn't tried it until you reached out, until you sent some of it out to me. And so I know very little about your process that you go through, which I'd also like to hear about, but I do think it's a unique product. And so I would love to hear about elevator pitch. Why Borrowed Page? What makes it different? Why is it different than what I walk past in the liquor store?
I'm not the guy to look at for an elevator pitch. I'm the most long-winded person in the entire world, but, basically this, once it became apparent to us that American single malt is likely to become standardized, and theoretically it will be. The 90-day comment period from the government ended, like, feels like a year ago, not that long ago, but a long time ago. I was excited for American single malt. I am excited for American single malt, but I was also a little, I have been very vocal on several platforms that I am not totally on board with the standards that have been proposed for American single malt. So I think I was sitting there, I was happy for them. I was happy for people that we've spoken to that, you know, are on the commission and have worked really hard to make that happen. But I was seeing that with American single malt being standardized, American whiskey as this sort of vague catch-all term for any American-made whiskey product that does not fit within one of the government standards for a whiskey, bourbon, rye, wheat, whatever. American whiskey was sort of the wild, wild west, the like last real area for true rampant experimentation and innovation within the American whiskey world. And so I think that's when something kind of clicked in my mind. I texted Chase immediately when I had the thought, which was, we've been talking about putting out a product of our own. Let's not just put together another bourbon or another rye to go out on the market and compete against everything else. Let's not just reach out to like Kings County Distillery and Few and whatever and say like, give us some bourbon barrels. Let's blend different styles of whiskey together to create American whiskey, because that's what it's going to have to be called, because it, you know, disqualifies it from the standards. And let's try to see if we can create something that is distinctive and different than anything else that's on the market, but also uses the individual components to highlight the distilleries that we worked with. So not only did it, you know, kind of crystallize this idea that we could create something kind of different and put something kind of different out on the market that challenges the idea of what American whiskey is and can be, but we can also do it in a way that really feels like an extension of what we're already doing with the website, which is trying to shine this light back on these craft distillers. So that's where the concept of what Borrowed Page ended up being came together.
Yeah, and just to piggyback very briefly, because that was a long elevator pitch.
Yeah, we went up to the 700th floor.
No problem.
I think the most exciting feedback we get, so I'm putting words in Devin's mouth, but the most exciting feedback we get about Borrowed Page is like, oh, like, I got this because I've heard of one of the distilleries. I'm a fan of one of the distilleries, but I hadn't tried anyone else. And now, like, it has become a platform through which, you know, people in Pittsburgh have learned about, you know, whiskey in Ohio or in Arizona. And so, like, in many ways, the product becomes, like Doug mentioned, an extension of this mission of ours on the website and the storytelling side, which is just to elevate the profile of craft whiskey.
Yeah, and I think it does an excellent job, and that's something I want to highlight, because I think most whiskey lovers, we like to dabble in the home blending, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, mix it up. And it is no easy feat to take X and Y and try to get Z. It almost never happens. So I think that it's a great way of looking at it, and I like that you mentioned the American whiskey aspect of it, is that it's going to taste different than a lot of the things you're going to walk past. And I like different. I like unique. My followers know that. My listeners know that. And then on top of that, like you just mentioned, you guys highlight the distilleries. You have it here on the bottle. So you know what it is that you're drinking. You're able to try all of that and create this unique profile that, you know, somehow manages to still highlight the distillers. And you still know, at the end of the day, no matter what flavor profile it is, good whiskey's good whiskey and bad whiskey's bad whiskey, and you know that it's quality whiskey in the bottle, which just is a testament to those distillers who contributed to it. Absolutely. I think that's fair to say.
Thank you.
Of course. And so, speaking of which, let's get into it a little bit. I'm drinking volume 2, you're drinking volume 1. We'll start with volume 1 since that came first. Let's talk a little bit about it. Now, I haven't drank it for a couple weeks now, but if I recall correctly, it was a little bit more bourbon forward than volume 2. Had a little bit more of that barrel spice, a little bit more of those bourbon characteristics. So let's get into it. What is volume 1? What can people expect, and what are you guys tasting?
Yeah, so you know, and you're right. Blending is no easy feat. And, you know, admittedly, Chase and I had actually done very little of that at home bar messing around. So I think something that gave us some validity that we were onto the right track is everybody that we told the idea to was like, this is a really cool idea. But then it came down to the part where we're like, all right, let's see if it's an idea that actually works. Because for a while, it was just an idea. So What is in volume 1, it is two different bourbons made two very different ways. So a majority of it is bourbon from Watershed Distillery in Columbus, Ohio.
Okay.
This is a pretty standard bourbon mash bill. It's a corn, rye, barley mash bill. Mm-hmm. So not, you know, breaking the mold too much there. It's column distilled, very much so like a traditional Kentucky bourbon would be. So the Watershed bourbon has a lot of really classic bourbon notes to it. Lots of vanilla, lots of caramel. It's very smooth. It's very easy on the palate. And it is the largest percentage of what is in volume 1. So I would definitely consider that to be basically the base spirit, the backbone. The other bourbon that is in this is from Spirits of French Lick in West Baden, Indiana, distilled by the, there's so many words you could use to describe Alan Bishop.
Infamous, I don't know.
Yeah, infamous, that's a good one. That kind of wraps them all up. the incomparable Alan Bishop. That is pot distilled, and it is a unique mash bill. It's a 4-grain bourbon. It's corn, wheat, oats, and barley. It's the Lee W. Sinclair bourbon that they make down at Spirits of French Lick, double pot distilled. That has a ton of body to it, a lot more spice, lots of good oils, and the oats on it or in it give it this incredible texture and mouthfeel. Volume 1 is almost 117 proof. It's over 58% alcohol, but I think the oats in the mash bill from the Lee W. Sinclair bourbon help make this whiskey a little bit more approachable at that proof. I don't think it drinks as hot as it is, even though it still has a good zing to it. The third whiskey in here is a Monongahela rye whiskey from Wiggle Whiskey in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A little bit of an homage to my first job in the industry, working as a brand ambassador for them. Their rye whiskey is really great. No corn in the mash bill at all. It's a rye, wheat, barley mash bill. And I think it brings a lot of that sort of classic, you know, black pepper, cinnamon spice, but also some beautiful stone fruit notes, which help lift this whiskey up in the mid palate. And then finally, probably the big curveball in an American whiskey is we threw some mesquite smoked single malt from Whiskey Del Bac out in Tucson, Arizona, which was an interesting choice to do for your first ever blend.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. That I didn't even know that that was the breakdown of that one. That is incredibly interesting. So that actually brought up a question for me, which is if you know, like you mentioned, you have this idea, you don't know if it's going to work or not. How did you guys get your feet wet with blending? I mean, there's no doubt in my mind, that the blends came out good. I mean, at the very least, I'm very much enjoying both of them. So my humble opinion from my podcast, but how did you get your feet wet? How'd you figure it out as you went?
Well, you know, I think one of the most rewarding pieces of this journey, both the written website and also the blending, is the community that we've been building along the way. And when we started kind of building this concept, like I mentioned, like, you know, a lot of whiskey credentials, but not like true blending, and certainly not on a, you know, release a product level. The community of distillers that we were working with at that first group really helped us kind of figure out how to go about doing it. And so there's this one wonderful woman named Ann Dimmick. She works now for the Ohio State Liquor Board, I believe. Yeah. Former, you know, she had ties to Watershed Distilling, which is how we got connected with her. And so really, when we started going down this path, we were like, oh, would you mind like kind of joining us, being a guest blender, teaching us the ropes a little bit, but then also like it gives us kind of this checks and balance of it's not just our palates and our noses and everything trying to bounce out. We had a third person who had actual credentialed expertise in this space to help us out.
Had blended something before.
I blended a product that was sold and purchased by people. So like it made us feel, and we honestly, like, I don't think we can, thank her enough, for her contributions, not just to volume one, but you know, a lot of what she taught us for volume one, we implemented for volume two. And this notion of a guest blender, we liked it so much, that we wanted, it's now kind of been instilled as a legacy piece into what we're going to do for every future volume. So for volume two, we worked with Ryan Mills. Some of you guys might know him by the handle, That One Dude Ryan. Really, because I think it helps just not make the whiskey about us and our kind of feedback loop of what each other think, but like, you know, is this something that people outside of us would like? Can we get the message about these craft producers via our page out to a wider audience? Can we learn a little bit about how other people's palates work by incorporating them into the process? So like the guest blending notion of it has been both kind of like, I don't know, functionally essential and like a really, really rewarding, enjoyable piece of the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. And actually, ironically, for my listeners, I record these things out of order. For my listeners, Ryan was two episodes ago. Ryan was just on. So
fantastic.
Kind of ironic that worked out really well. I talk with Ryan quite a bit. That explains a lot. You bring in guest blenders. He mentioned that he worked with you on volume two as well. And it really, I like that idea of the checks and the balances. I mean, obviously I don't have that when I'm down in my basement saying, I'm grab this and put it in there and grab that. But that's really interesting. That's neat to think about. I know at least for those of us at home who have seen how difficult it is to make something actually taste good, you know. So that explains most of volume one. And what I'm drinking right now is volume two, which is what I'm excited to get into as well. And basically I picked volume two just because it was the most recent. So I would have mentioned this in the intro that I'm going to stitch to the beginning, but for everybody listening, these are both available on my bottle shop. So if you go to the link in my bio, you can get these bottles from there if you're curious about what we're drinking. But let's get into volume two. I had to throw that plug in there. Let's get into it. Volume two is everything we just described with the barrel, the vanilla, the bourboniness. We're taking a complete change of gears here. And so what exactly, how would you nail down volume two?
Well, I'll approach that from two angles, which is that when we started the Borrowed Page project, part of that concept was that every time we do a new release, a new volume, it's going to be different distilleries, those distilleries are always going to be ones that we've already featured on the website. So we're not going to be working with people that we don't already have an established relationship with, whose story we haven't already told. Different styles of whiskey. So we want every release of Borrowed Page to be different from the previous one, to be different from all of the previous ones.
And not just subtly different. Like we want to use it as a vehicle to explore a totally different concept or avenue about what whiskey could be.
Right. Again, because part of the concept of Borrowed Page is that it's there to challenge the idea of what American whiskey is. So each release will continue that conversation and that story. So that's the first part of it. And the sad part of that, I think that's really cool. It's something that that keeps me excited about this, because every time we go into Borrowed Page, it's not like, all right, we got to try to recreate what we just did with volume one or volume two. It's, you know, what can we do next? What's interesting and different in the whiskey world out there? Who's doing something, you know, in a very interesting way that we can help share that story and share that profile, that flavor profile. The sad part of it is that once these releases are gone, we're not going to recreate them again. So, for example, we made about 700 bottles of volume one. We're about halfway through that inventory. Once volume one is sold out, you'll never be able to buy, like, we'll never make volume one again. Same thing with volume two, volume three, and every subsequent release. So with that in mind, when we started having the conversation about volume two and how we were going to, you know, own up to that mission, the thing that we kind of settled on, what became the North Star sort of for volume two, was no bourbon. Bourbon makes up 58% of volume one when you add spirits of French Lick and Watershed together. So, and you know, a lot of American whiskeys out there that are being made by craft producers, a lot of them are bourbon and rye blends.
Right.
You know, the only real big curveball in volume one is 10% of that mesquite smoked single malt thrown in there to really mess with your mind.
Right.
So no bourbon was what we agreed on for volume two. And that's kind of where it started.
Go ahead.
No. I'm talking too much. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. I love the amount of detail. Seriously. It totally shows. I mean, so if you put these in front of me blind and I assumed it was from a category, I would say volume one, that's a bourbon. Volume two, that's a scotch. Like, if you put those in front of me, that's what I would guess. But with volume two, there's a lot more going on than just scotch in terms of the flavor. So I'd like, go ahead and break down, if you could, the distillers and the whiskeys that went together to make this blend. Oh, and then I want to talk about what it tastes like, because I think it's pretty interesting.
So volume two is made up with whiskeys from three different distilleries. So we worked with four distilleries in volume one, three distilleries in volume two, but I think five different whiskeys in volume two. So there's two different rye barrels from Mammoth Distilling up in northern Michigan. One was very representative of their classic woolly rye. That's what they call their flagship rye up there. And then one barrel was very different. And we can dive deeper into why that barrel was different later on if you want to. But sure. It was really cool. So we bought both of them. There's two different American single malts from Virginia Distillery Company in Lovingston, Virginia. One that was aged in a first fill Oloroso sherry cask, and one that was aged in a first fill red wine cuvée cask. And then finally, we have a local Colorado distillery, Talnua, and they make American single pot still whiskey. So single pot still, more of an Irish style of whiskey where you're using a combination of both malted barley and raw barley in the mash. Yeah. And then they throw a little bit of an American spin on it. And then we have kind of a cool representation of their whiskey in volume two, because it's sort of their Solera method version of that whiskey that's in volume two. So five different whiskeys, rye, two different ryes, two different single malts, and then a American single pot still.
Okay. Now, I do want to get into the special Mammoth barrel, because Mammoth does some weird stuff, and they do it well. I actually had a sample of their stuff on the show, I don't know how many episodes ago now, but when I had Blind Barrels on the show, and I was blown away by it. And so I do want to, I want to know what that was. But I want to touch on everything you just said, because it kind of explains what I was tasting. I hadn't looked very much. I've seen the distillers on here. I hadn't looked very much into the blend aside from that. And I've had one scotch give me this really weird flavor that it's not even, it doesn't even match the flavor notes they say you should get, but it just reminds me of like a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. That is Glenmorangie Quinta Rubin. I don't know why. It just does. The port wine and the maltiness is like bread. This kind of reminds me of like a jelly on toast. And you mentioned it's got the one has a wine finish. The single pot still, if it is similar to an Irish whiskey in taste, I often get that kind of grainy, granola-y type taste. And that sort of culminates the rye whiskey from Mammoth. What I've had from Mammoth before has a nice sweetness to it, and it kind of livens that up. You get a little bit of that spice with it. And so it all culminates into what reminds me a little bit of jelly on toast, I guess.
There you go.
And isn't it, I think everyone can agree, that's a very comforting kind of like, yeah. You know, thing. I think that's right. You know, like when we kind of walked away from volume one in a weird default way, I think we both kind of made it to our palates, which is really big, pretty hot, very peppery. And we wanted to make something to prove out this concept that volume two is here and that the series is going to be very different each step of the way. And so we went for this kind of totally different, a little bit sweeter, a little bit maltier, very, very, you know, sessionable in my mind, something that like, if it's a hot day, you can still drink it and really enjoy. But I'm with you. I think there's something that's almost like nostalgic and very just comforting about it. Like it's easy to drink. It's sweet in the right way, but it's still dynamic. It has that pepperiness. So it's not too much malt sweetness and not enough, you know, variety. I mean, I'm biased. I like it, but.
Well, and something that jumped out to us when we were blending about all of these is that it all together, it becomes a sort of like cornucopia of fruit on the nose, at least, because
yes.
The rye whiskeys from Mammoth gave it a little bit of this like cinnamon raisin bread pudding kind of quality to it. The sherry cask single malt had all these fresh berry notes, raspberries, strawberries. That's probably where a lot of that like jelly situation is coming from. The cuvée cask brought in like darker fruits, like dried fruit, dark cherry, that kind of stuff. And then the single pot still had this like bananas foster, this like caramelized banana quality to it. So it just became this really like incredible whiskey on the nose. It was so inviting.
And honestly, like when we went into it, we were really thinking about more replicating volume one, which was you got one barrel from each, you know, of the options, and you figure out the balancing and whatnot. And here, like as we started playing with it, with Ryan and whatnot, it's like we couldn't, you know, we really love the sherry, but like we couldn't walk away from the cuvée. Like we didn't want to not include it. And same with the two different ryes for Mammoth is like we both really like them for different ways, and we kind of see how they piece together. And so pretty
well. And then we didn't even know if we were going to be able to use the sherry.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, the sherry. So one of the things Anne taught us in Volume One is if you can use the entire barrel in your blend. First of all, we don't have the infrastructure or the logistics to handle having excess. Like
of you got to love the economics of that.
Yeah,
right.
Every drop. So that's just like whenever I'm doing a blend, that's how I start. I start a blend assuming I'm going to use every drop in this barrel, and then I see how it is. And if I need to change or adjust, then we will. And luckily that worked out for Volume One. We were able to dump every drop of all of the barrels that we wanted into Volume One, no problem. That did not work out in Volume Two because we loved the sherry cask from Virginia Distillery Company. I would say of all the samples we got, it was probably the favorite for all three of us. Mm. It was so good. It is a sherry butt. So there was about 140 gallons of that sherry single malt in that barrel. When we did the blend, assuming that you use everything, the sherry just blew the entire blend up. The sherry ended up actually being more challenging to blend with than the mesquite smoke, which is hilarious. But we had to, we kept working on and dialing the sherry down and down and down and down and down until we felt like we had the right proportion of everything. But at the end of the day, we were like, it would only amount to about 20 gallons of the sherry. So I, you know, when we were blending, we actually ended our, that call with two different versions of volume two, one that had the sherry at 20 gallons and one that didn't have the sherry at all, because we didn't know if I basically was going to go back to Virginia and say, will you just siphon off 20 gallons of this and we'll just buy 20 gallons. But we didn't know if we were going to say yes or not to that. So luckily they did, because we did prefer that version of the blend. But yeah, for a minute, we had two different versions of volume two, and we just didn't know which one was going to fly.
Wow. Okay. And so then that's how you end up making it work. Then it has that bit of sherry in it to add that little extra. Wow. That is interesting. I love the fruit cornucopia comparison. I mean, it is fruity on the nose. When we first sat down, I was actually thinking more along the lines of like a citrus, which I get a lot of times from malt. But then, like I said, I got that jam, which is like that berry that you mentioned. It is all sorts of different things going on at once. And I also like the descriptor you guys used. You said it's comforting. And it is. It's comforting in the best kind of way for me personally, because I like it. It's approachable. It's sweet. It's easy. But it is, what, 55%? 55%, which is right at like a proof point I like. I'm a big 115 kind of guy. And so it's still kind of challenging for – not challenging, intriguing, especially for somebody who's a bit experienced enough to grasp all those different flavors. A lot of times, especially – I'm in Ohio. Full disclosure, my scotch selection's terrible. And so if you get a good complex scotch, it's like 43% probably, or you're paying over $100. Yeah. So I like having that little bit of both. You get a little bit of that alcohol. You get, doesn't taste too watered down, but you get that huge kind of fruity punch along with that malt, which is really enjoyable.
Yeah. Now, and just to cut you off, just because I'm seeing a natural segue, and I know you didn't ask about proofing, you just were commenting on it. Proofing
will
become one of those interesting things that, like, when we started thinking about blending, or really about doing this project whole, we really didn't think about, like, what are our lines in the sand? What are our standard policies, procedures, practices to kind of help create not a consistency in the product, but a consistency in approach, so you can replicate something that feels like, oh, that's an American mash and grain kind of style or bar pitch style product. And proofing has been one of those, you know, things where we've just kind of arbitrarily said, we're going to proof it at whatever we think it drinks best at, with the provision that we won't proof below 100.
Yeah.
And really, again, for a small company with no capital, you know, it's economically foolish, but, you know, we write 10-page articles in a time where people have 30-second attention span. So maybe that's the common theme here.
Yeah. we're bad at this, but we're doing okay.
and so that has just organically kind of risen, and I think really, again, an endemic kind of fingerprint or legacy piece, I think she was involved in that, was like, we just kind of, that has become the proofing philosophy, whatever it drinks best at. And for volume one, that happened to be barrel proof, and for volume two, that happened to be 110, but we don't even test it. But if we can't get it to drink at a level we want above 100, we don't go with that blend.
Okay. That's very interesting. That's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a part of the process that I don't think a lot of people think about. Especially now, we see a ton of 80 and barrel proof. So that's a part of the blending process that not a lot of people think about, is what proof does this drink best at? Go ahead.
Yeah, I said, honestly, it's, again, not something that we thought about, or at least me personally didn't think too much about that piece until we kind of stumbled upon, oh, well, what proof do we release at that moment? Like, oh, we had no plan for that. And so we made a plan in the moment, volume one. I think it is one of the trickier pieces of the puzzle.
It's really hard.
Because, like, I made a bad assumption that it would, the proofing it down would affect the flavor in a linear way, right? It just becomes a milder, version of its true self. It really isn't that way at all.
We saw that with volume one a lot.
It's a little bit erratic. So for volume one,
incredible at barrel strength.
Yeah.
Really weird at 110.
Didn't like it 110.
And then similar to what it was at barrel strength, but just had lost its soul a little bit.
At 100. So, yeah. And so we really came down to like, we loved it at barrel strength. We liked it at 100 and we had a big economics debate on, because that yields a lot more bottles.
Yeah.
And then we really just disliked it at 110, which we would have thought would have been a nice kind of compromise. If you liked it at 100, loved it at barrel strength, maybe 110 was
well, there. And that scared us a little bit too, because then we were like, is it going to be even worse at 100? Like, are we just basically water revealing flaw, like a major flaw in this whiskey?
Okay.
That we couldn't taste at barrel strength. And then when it kind of returned to form at 100, we were like, oh, okay, no. It's just that specific amount of water makes it into something really strange.
Yeah, it's just, we create versions upon versions, and you start thinking you get a feel of like, oh, if I add a little bit of this or if I remove a little bit of that, you can anticipate what the relative effect will be. And actually, it just kind of goes, it's, you know, Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. It just, you know, starts going in a weird direction. So it's, I don't know.
Volume 2 was pretty good.
Volume 2 was a little bit easier to manage.
At every proof, but it was the best at 110.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's a good point, because that's something that's counterintuitive as well sometimes, especially whiskey noobs, right there in the name. I work with a lot of newer folks to the whiskey industry, to whiskey collecting, whiskey drinking, whiskey enthusiasm. And something that's counterintuitive that I've actually been posting about lately is not just proof, but also spiciness in your profile. You would think less always means it's a more welcoming whiskey, but sometimes it'll get so boring when you proof it down or when you take out that spice that all you taste is the alcohol. Then it's like, this burns more, but it's lower proof. Why is that the case? Because you're not getting enough to distract you from the alcohol. Is it something that can really happen sometimes?
Yeah.
And I think that is probably why we don't really consider much below 100. I mean, I think we could probably put out a really nice 95 or 90 whiskey, and you know what? Maybe we will one day. Like part of mine and Chase's things is that, like, you know, we chose a specific category of whiskey that works because it is not restricted by standards. So why would we impose a bunch of standards on ourselves? So for the most part, we do operate without limitation.
Yeah.
But
you gotta have a code.
But I do think that, you know, piggybacking off of something Chase said earlier, if there's something that I think will probably unite borrowed page releases in perpetuity, is that they are going to be bold, complex, flavorful whiskeys. They, you know, they might not all be for everybody. There might be, you know, there might be one that you like more than the other, but I don't think that anybody, at least with the two we've put out so far, can argue that they are not big and bold and flavorful.
And again, going back to maybe just these bold, irrational way of how we do everything. It's like, oh, like you took this big financial risk, you release a product, you developed some fans, and then you go for your follow-up, do something completely different. And those fans, like I know people personally who are big bourbon people, they really like volume one. I was like, you gotta try volume two. And they're like, yeah, it's not for me. And that's fine. But again, a terrible, like if you're trying to build a business, a terrible, terrible idea.
But then I've spoken to a bunch of people who love volume two more than volume one.
So who knows?
Right. No, I mean, like you said, it's maybe a little counterintuitive, but it's also putting out all these different expressions and introducing people to all these different expressions, which I think is awesome. And that's why, like I said, like, obviously, on my channel, I do a lot of bourbon just because that's what's accessible to me. But I can absolutely appreciate Volume 2 because it's so different. It's like I said, if you put it in front of me, I might assume it was scotch, but it doesn't taste like any of the scotches on my shelf right now. I mean, it's different. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, my dad's a big Macallan fan. That's probably his like go-to whiskey. And it's funny, when we were blending this whiskey, I was like, my dad's going to like this one.
Oh yeah, especially you get that little bit of that sherry at the end. I know that's the Macallan I have, at least, is the sherry cask. Yeah, That is fantastic. And so volume two, just to give a brief rundown for those who are listening, waiting for my review. I mean, you guys, we did discuss it a little bit, and I think everything you mentioned plays into it so well. The Bananas Foster is expressed for me in a way that's like this approachable kind of creamy sweetness that kind of is the backdrop to that cornucopia you mentioned. And it is that cornucopia of fruit. To me, when you combine the creamy sweet Bananas Foster, the buttery granola single pot still, and that fruit cornucopia, it is jelly on toast. That's what it's reminding me of. Very enjoyable. At 55%, I actually didn't know it was until you mentioned volume one was cask strength. And I was like, I didn't even read what strength this was. And I saw 55 and I was like, I need to pump the brakes a little bit. I've already refilled once. So this is going to be a good interview. I better slow down. Very good. Very enjoyable. Easy sipper. I'm not just saying that. You guys know. You guys sent me these to try. I don't have people on the podcast if I don't like the stuff that they make. So I like this. I can say that. No,
We're thrilled that you like it. And one last cool fact about Volume 2, which was actually something that was – we did not talk about it at all. And I didn't even realize it until – after it came out and we were promoting it by doing Instagram lives with, you know, all the different participants. This is a 100% pot distilled whiskey. Mammoth pot distills their whiskey. Virginia pot distills their whiskey. And Taunua pot distills their whiskey. So not a drop of this whiskey touched a column at any point during the process, which was not intentional. But definitely a cool aspect of it.
Definitely a good point. Probably helps contribute to that kind of rounded flavor. A lot of times with the column stills, you can get that more, ethanol-ish, alcohol-ish flavor. That actually makes a lot of sense. And you reminded me, because I forgot to ask almost, this special mammoth barrel. Are you able to disclose what it was?
Of course, yeah. So, you know, we've seen a lot of different barrel samples at this point in our short whiskey career. We've seen barrel samples that have numbers on them. We've seen barrel samples that have letters and numbers. But this was the first time that we saw a barrel sample that just had letters. No numbers at all, which was very weird. And it just said RTB. So we had to reach out to Mammoth, and RTB stands for Royal Tannenbaum. This was a 53-gallon barrel of rye that leaked out of that barrel. Once they realized it, they had to recooper it into a 30-gallon barrel because they had lost, you know, the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So this is technically a double-oaked version of their rye whiskey. It was significantly higher in proof, so it had a much greater angel share of water. The other barrel that we bought was like 109. This one was like 129 proof.
Wow.
So it was higher in proof. It had spent more time in smaller cooperage. It was older. It was over three years old in a 30-gallon barrel, double oaked. This thing was wild.
Yeah. Big, yeah.
The flavor on it was crazy. The tannins on it were crazy. That's hence the name. But the texture of it, the one thing that the other barrel we bought from Mammoth was missing was body. So we thought that if we bought both of them, the 862 barrel, which is the other one that we bought, would be great for representing what Mammoth does with rye, with their woolly rye expression. And then we thought the Royal Tannenbaum is going to bring some extra depth and extra texture and body to this whiskey. And it was a great call. Great call by us.
Yeah.
Wow.
Genius.
You killed it. Great job. Yeah. No, that's very intriguing. And I mean, usually too much tannin can kind of be, but that it didn't, you know, it didn't come through as too much at all. But once again, it's the 30-gallon versus.
And honestly, like, I think the maltiness and the sweetness really balances it out.
Yes.
And so, like, it just becomes a little bit of variety, right? In kind of the experience of the whole thing without it overpowering anyway. Like, that jam on toast still very much is kind of the underpinning experience.
I think we knew that the blend could handle the RTB because those single malts were so present.
Yeah, malt is one of those things, and I know we're on tangents now. Malt is like very prominent. It does, it, like a little bit goes a very long way. And yeah. since we had such a high portion of malt, finding the balancing of things.
Even the Mammoth mash bill kind of has a high malt content. I can't remember. I want to say it's like 88 rye, 12 barley. Don't quote me on that.
Put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
Quote
them. Yeah. Even the Mammoth has a relatively high malted barley content in it. So considering that the rye is high malted barley and then everything else in this whiskey is barley. Yeah. You know, I think it could, those extra tannins were welcome.
Yeah.
It almost came as a balancing factor that kept it from going just all the way to the sweet buttery rye barley, malted barley.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. So, as we wrap up here, we've gone through both borrowed pages, both of which, once again, are available at the link in my bio. But as we wrap up here, anything that you guys want to mention coming down the pipeline for American Mash and Grain? What kind of tempo you guys release these on, if there are plans for Volume 3 yet, or anything you'd like to disclose before we wrap up?
We have concepts for both Volume 3 and Volume 4 kind of figured out. We don't know which is 3 and which is 4. One of those concepts to bring it to life would require us to go back to a distillery that's previously told us no to actually now convince them to become a yes. So TBD on that front.
Never give up.
But we don't have a timeline for release right now. At this moment in time, the way it's working is we use the revenue from Volume 1 to fund Volume 2, and we really use the revenue from Volume 2 to fund Volume 3. And so we're a bit at the mercy of
cash flow
and trying to figure that out. We would like to get Volume 3 out before the end of the year or really early Q1 of 24. But TBD, no hard date yet on that.
Yeah. You want to see Volume 3 sooner? Go out there and buy some borrowed page.
I hear the link is in his profile. So
the link is in my bio.
The profile.
There you go. Go get it.
and then we're also doing some interesting things on the storytelling and media side of things. Again, it's where we started and still very much at our core, right? Like the product itself is fantastic, but really is a vehicle for storytelling, for introducing people to these independent craft producers. Still the core of what we're doing is that platform of trying to tell these people's stories. And so we're looking at ways of expanding our storytelling capacity, trying to release more than one article a month. So that's hopefully something we can kind of get some pieces in place before the end of the year. And then can we tease? I think we've down a path. We're looking about potentially releasing a podcast adaptation for some of our articles. We do an interview based. The podcast itself will not be an interview. It's not going to be a back and forth. Again, trying to do things a little bit differently, more in this storytelling kind of narrative style.
More like a NPR, This American Life kind of storytelling method for whiskey stories.
Devin had not consented for me spilling those beans. So let's see how he responds after we hang up.
That's okay. I can cut those beans out if we need to.
Faster.
So this is part time for us. We're trying to find ways to make it full time. But in the interim, it's really just how can we keep moving forward.
Well, and now that Chase just moved. When we're recording this podcast, Chase just moved back to Colorado
4 days ago.
I
don't even have internet, which is why we're in the same room.
Otherwise, we would refuse to be in the same room. It's in our contract, but this is the first time that Chase and I have lived in the same state since we were 18. And I think now that we're both here in Colorado, another thing that we're hoping to do is because we want to build the company out here in Colorado. It's why we both moved here. So I think it's trying to figure out how to set some roots and how to engage a little bit more with the local Colorado community as well.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, that all sounds very exciting. I'm looking forward, Volume 1 versus Volume 2 is so different. I can't wait to see the spin that Volumes 3 and 4 have. I can tell you I'm definitely looking forward to that. And I think you guys have exciting things ahead of you. I love the storytelling aspect of it. Obviously, I try to do a little bit of that myself. So I think, you know, it just lends itself well to whiskey. And I'm excited to see what you guys come up with for Volume 3. Volumes 1 and 2 so far, I'm very much enjoying. I will be drinking, especially in the summertime, this cornucopia of fruit. I will be enjoying this for the remainder of the summer, without a doubt.
Yeah, but, then sneak back to Volume 1 in the fall and the winter when you need that big high-proof kick in the, you know.
Or if you're out camping and it's cool in the evening, yeah. You know, and you want a little smoke next to the camp.
Barbecuing, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Volume 1's taken home some awards, so if anybody wants to see some of the medals and stuff Volume 1 has gotten, we've been pretty humbled by the response on that front.
Yes, and I will put the website in the show notes so people are able to find it through there. Go check it out. Go read the articles. Go see these craft distillers that took part in these borrowed page volumes. But I think, you know, that covers the two borrowed pages we have so far. I will have to, at the very least, try and review Volume 3 for those who are listening and are as excited as I am.
We'll make sure you get it through.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. I can't wait to try it. But Devin and Chase, I appreciate you guys coming on the show. You've been super informative, and I can't wait to see what the road ahead of you looks like.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Yep.
Thank you guys for listening to another episode of Whiskey Noobs. If you need more Whiskey Noobs content in your life, make sure you check out our Patreon page in the show notes. And if you like the show, please make sure to leave a 5-star rating or review. It only takes a couple of minutes, and they're way more helpful than people realize. If you want to do tastings alongside the show, make sure you join the email list by sending an email to whiskeynoobspodcast@gmail.com with a subject line that says email list. You'll receive monthly emails with a list of the whiskeys that will be featured throughout the month so that you can buy them ahead of time. You can also find more Whiskey Noobs content on Instagram @whiskey_noobs and on TikTok @whiskeynoobspodcast. Once again, thank you guys for listening. The Whiskey Noobs podcast does not support underage or otherwise irresponsible consumption of alcohol.